This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3643, for Wednesday, the 20th of July, 2022. Today's show is entitled, My Computing History and the Software I Use. It is the first show by new host BinRC and is about 56 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is, rambling about my computing history and tech stack.
Okay, so this is a re-record. I previously recorded this in my car, but my voice recording application crashed. The idea behind recording in the car was that it's easier to noise reduce constant road noise than the hypothetical dog barking and birds chirping. But hopefully I'll be able to normalize this a little bit better. I had two audio records. Actually, the first time I recorded the episode, the quality of the content wasn't there because I was very tired. But I have very long drives home. I'll try not to peak the mic and kind of cause audio problems, because I will try to normalize it in the end. In this show, I want to talk about my computing history. I might have to pause halfway through and get a drink because I just finished recording and I'm kind of hell-bent on getting this episode uploaded. And I will attempt to speak more clearly because I don't have road noise right into my actual microphone, not just a microphone that plugs into the 3.5 millimeter audio jack on my phone. So let's see how I got started in computing. The first time I remember touching a computer, my mother had purchased a Dell Dimension. It's right next to me. I'd have to pull it out and make a lot of noise to look at it. I think it's 2600 or 4600. But that's what it was, Dell Dimension. I think she probably paid way too much money for it. You all remember growing up the "you've got mail" sound, because your mom had a whole bunch of AOL CDs, right? The free trial AOL CDs. It was a Windows XP machine. I remember playing Space Pinball on it and Kid Pix. I really liked Kid Pix because, you know, you had all the cool ways of making art that mom wouldn't let you touch in real life because it was too messy. You know, the spray paint one or the rainbow one. Kid Pix was a very fun game. I need to see if I can find a Kid Pix CD somewhere. See if I can't get it to run through Wine or something. I bet you it's old enough. I bet you it'd just work. I think that was the earliest memory. I still have that tower. It doesn't actually run. The tower's non-functional. The motherboard just rusted out. It got left inside of a garage for many years. And as you know, heat and humidity changes, drastic temperature and humidity changes will cause your computer to fail. I haven't checked it. It's in a box somewhere. I actually know exactly where it is, but I'm not going to pull it out. It doesn't work, and I don't know why I still hold on to it. It's garbage. I've salvaged all the functional parts from it, but it's still here somewhere. And then I think the next thing, the next computing memory I have is sort of the American memory that most of us share. What we might call the Microsoft indoctrination classes. Indoctrination because, you know, Church of Emacs and, you know, the evil Church of Bill Gates, Microsoft indoctrination classes in school. But that's really what it is and was, is Microsoft would give schools free Windows licensing, free Microsoft program licenses, in order to teach students how to use Microsoft-specific tooling. And I didn't particularly enjoy these classes because, you don't actually learn how the computer works. It's almost click the button to do the thing. The only skill they teach you is how to navigate the seven circles of context menu hell, and there's not really much theory behind it. Like I said, it's just click the button to do the thing. And it's not very enjoyable, an enjoyable way of using computers, or really even all that productive way, a way that's all that productive of using computers. I think the next computing memory I have, the next big one, is sometime in high school. I took the state that I live in, the education system's kind of strange. So not only do school districts have classes, right? You can take like online specific classes, but there are classes that the state puts on. So, you know, state of whatever game development class. So in high school, it was a game development class, in air quotes. It was more so a game theory class. You know, the theory behind video games and sort of that type of thing. I don't remember very much about it because the other boys in the class and I, it was a small class, right? It was, you know, an elective, sort of shoehorned in. We did get like a supervisor, right? She didn't teach the class because it was online, and supervisor is the wrong word. But that's the only word I can think of, because she supervised us in order to make sure we were actually doing work and not just watching YouTube videos in class, in that class time. So we finished the coursework quite quickly. That was kind of one of the things about the online classes, is it's very easy to finish them, because you just sit down and work and you just get it done, especially if it's intuitive stuff. You can kind of cut out the middleman for your "I finished the class" credit by doing it online. And you learn just about as much, which is not a whole lot. But we finished early, so the supervisor, that's the wrong word, but I'm going to keep using it. The supervisor for the class, she said, "Hey, why don't you guys learn something about web development, because you still have half a trimester of this hour of class left, and you can't just do nothing." So she set us on to W3 Schools, I think is the one where she sent us. I don't like W3 Schools, and very quickly I learned to dislike it, because it's not very useful, compared to the Mozilla developer documentation. The Mozilla docs are much more thorough, and they tell you what is and is not standards compliant, what is and is not deprecated, what is and is not best practice. Although I disagree with the Mozilla documentation when they suggest people use non-free text editors and sort of non-Unixy text editors, or I guess traditional text editors. Use an IDE. It's like, you don't need an IDE for web development. It's just Markdown. Right, that's what the M in HTML stands for, is markup. You don't need an IDE to do any heavy lifting for you whatsoever. Even with CSS or PHP or JavaScript, you know, just learn how it works, and you don't need to use whatever IDE Mozilla tells you. But that's kind of a tangent, tangentially related to web development, is the Mozilla documentation instructing people to go and pay for Visual Studio, which is sort of counterintuitive to their entire open source mission. You know, go use this proprietary editor that's based on our Google Chrome. That's our enemy. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense that they would even recommend that editor when there are a million free editors to choose from, that are quite frankly more practical and more functional and more usable, right? Stay out of your way. That's my end goal in an editor, is something that stays out of the way. But I can talk about editors later. I'm talking about computing history. So shortly after that web development class, or that sort of nothing burger of a game dev class turning into a web dev class, my mother had bought me a HP netbook. And for anyone who's ever had to use an HP netbook, I think you'll resonate with me that trying to get anything done, trying to do any work whatsoever on an HP netbook, it's an exercise in futility, and it's a penance in itself, right? A penance for the sins of the fathers who thought it was a good idea to build this darn thing, this netbook crap. But let me talk about this netbook. I think it kind of forged me into a better Unix user, more systems administrator-y type person, because it was so painful to use. Okay, so the hardware specs on this thing, 25 or 32 gigabytes of internal storage. That storage is eMMC, I think is the acronym. What type of storage it is, right? In layman's terms, it's basically an SD card welded to, or soldered to the motherboard. Weld is the wrong word here. It's basically an SD card soldered to the motherboard, which means the more you use it, the more unreliable it becomes, right? Each time your laptop dies, which laptops do, the power goes out, right? It has a battery. Each time the laptop dies, it becomes, you're taking a gamble on whether or not it'll turn back on or even boot. I think it had 4 gigabytes of RAM, so enough to get things done. Not using Windows 10 though, right? That's what it came pre-installed with, was Windows 10. 4 gigabytes of RAM and 32 gigabytes of disk space. That's about the minimum that Windows 10 operating system can run on without any programs, without any external programs whatsoever. That 32 gigabytes of disk space, that's a bare bones Windows 10 installation, and you can't even run updates. So what happens in Windows 10 is, you get the Microsoft gun put to your head, update now or else, you can't use your computer anymore. Sort of that scary message that, the forced updates that we all suffered through. I think I had a Celeron too, but that's almost inconsequential. Windows 10 doesn't work if you don't have 4 cores, right? Your Celeron's single core, 2 threads, and it's very underpowered for the garbage fire, the big dumpster fire that is Windows 10. But it was unusable, right? Windows 10 is entirely unusable on every piece of hardware. What that means is, you can't even try to get by on something as minimal as a netbook. So I asked around, and a friend told me that I should install Linux, because Linux just works. I think that was his words, right? Just works, trademark Unicode character, which is kind of funny because that's what I tell people now. Why are you using Windows? Linux just works, trademark Unicode character. Kind of a funny thing. So I said, okay, so I looked what Linux was, and I was like, there's a lot of these. What one should I install? And he said, you can pick Ubuntu, but it's kind of big. It's kind of heavy for that little netbook. And sometimes Ubuntu can be a pain when it breaks. So he said, the latest, baby's first Linux distribution, the popular one right now, that's gaining traction. And, the traction's useful because you have other people asking the same questions, Googling the same things, asking the same things on Stack Overflow, specifically with the distribution name in the title. This distribution was Linux Mint. So I went to their website and I said, hey, there's a lot of different downloads here. What one should I pick? And he said, those are basically just different desktop environments, different usage paradigms. He says kind of like iPhone versus Android, how you use them a little bit differently, even though under the hood it's pretty much the same thing. Under the hood they're both Unix systems, both non-GNU Unix systems, albeit slightly different, but the higher level abstracted interface paradigm. So I said there's 3 of them. There's one called Cinnamon, one called Mate, and one called XFCE. And he said, Cinnamon's a bit heavy. for something that has only 2 threads and 4 gigabytes of RAM, it won't be a very fun experience. Mate is like old GNOME 2. I didn't know what a GNOME was at the time, but I you know, Mate's pretty Windows-like. It'll be familiar to you. And then XFCE is very lightweight, but sometimes you have to do the heavy lifting as the end user. If you, there's not a whole lot of people publishing their own XFCE, I guess, applet, the thing that sits in your system tray. There's not a whole lot of people building those types of things and then publishing them and making them easy to find. So we said, just go with Mate. So that's what I did. I installed Linux Mint Mate version. And the interesting thing he told me at this time is it doesn't matter which kind you choose because you don't have to reinstall. You can just install that other thing. Hypothetically, if you had enough disk space, you could install all 3 of the desktops and then pick between them, and you can always change at a later date. Right? It's not a permanent decision picking a desktop. So that's what I did. I installed Linux Mint on this netbook, and I used it for about 2 or 3 months. It must have only been 2 months. No, it was shorter than that. It was only 1 month that I ran Linux Mint. The reason being, I had apt problems. The package manager is sort of an exercise in futility. Right? I'm going to keep using these words, exercise in futility and penance. The penance being bearing the burden of the sins of the fathers who made this bad decision, this bad computing decision. So I very quickly started writing HTML again. There was a brief gap in time when I had stopped doing any web dev type stuff. And I started up again. It's like riding a bike, right? Markdown languages are like riding a bike. You don't ever forget because it's just so simple. HTML is not a real programming language. You have to read documentation for a programming language after you learn it. For various function calls and system calls. But for a markup language, which is what the M in HTML stands for, like I previously stated, once you learn it, you don't forget it. Sometimes you just have to double check when something is behaving strangely. And I think other things I did, someone said, hey, you should write C++. And in retrospect, I think they were pranking me because C++ is the worst possible programming language to tell someone who's never programmed anything outside of, CSS selector logic. That wasn't very fun. I spent a lot of time learning the Unix shell. I think it was actually Bash at the time. Because the idea behind Bash is someone's told me, all of those commands you're learning, you can write a thing called a shell script that pretty much just runs those commands. So I learned a lot about bash scripting specifically, which I almost regret. And now I instruct people and I lead them, not astray, but towards POSIX because, bashisms give me a headache and I don't want to help them troubleshoot bashisms when POSIX shell does everything you need it to do, and when it doesn't, you should be writing, you should be using a real programming language instead of trying to do it all in shell. I learned LaTeX at the time. I don't write much LaTeX anymore. Now if I need LaTeX, I will. Sometimes I write R Markdown. I don't use R very much, but sometimes I'll write R Markdown and then build it to LaTeX. Or I'll use Markdown and then use Pandoc to sort of build a PDF or what I do mostly if people care about presentation. People think LaTeX is ugly. I don't. I think it's quite charming. But now what I do for document preparation is I will write it in Markdown, render it to HTML, and then print the web page in Firefox because some of these people, they don't understand that things can look not like a web page. So they're a little bit confused when you bring them a serif font document with wide margins and page numberings and, this official looking thing. They don't really like that. Or at least in my anecdotal experience, they don't really like that. Let's see what else. What else did I learn how to do? I started learning Vim. You know, when you first get into Linux and Unix, you sort of become aware of this subculture in the editor work, right? So people are like saying Vim is better. No, Emacs is better. You know, and you see all the different memes where it's like average Vim user, and it's like a diagram of the different parts of the brain. You know, one of those like t-shirts you see little kids wearing, where it's like it's a diagram of a brain. It's like video games and, you know, soda, and, you know, bike riding, right? They'll put different things to the parts of the brain. But the Vim user one is like Vim key bindings, and that's the entire brain. That's the joke. And then the Emacs user version, it's like an octopus on a keyboard, because you need you know, octopus hands, or the Emacs foot pedal meme. I can't remember who, which person it was or which website, but someone out there actually has like a USB foot pedal they use in order to be able to use Emacs. So I started learning Vim. I've used Emacs here and there. I think the longest stretch was about 6 months, but I had to stop using it. Pushing the Control and Alt keys a lot, it gave me RSI in my hands. So I had to stop doing that. Vim, although sometimes I get tired of pressing the Escape key, I don't press it as often. As often anymore as when I first started using Vim, but I started learning Vim at the time. Sort of the concept of modal editing, and I think this was about the point after I installed a bunch of LaTeX stuff and was writing LaTeX and Vim. Something about apt broke on this Linux Mint system. And it was probably something I could troubleshoot now, like a dpackage error, or sort of an apt cache broke type thing. But in the time, I even tried searching the error message and asking on Linux Mint IRC, and none of the answers they told me fixed it. So then on a forum post, I saw the people were posting their different distributions with the, you know, NeoFetch thread. Sort of a cringe program, but like, you know, my distribution's cool. This is my identity, this logo, you know, this cool logo in the terminal. Someone posted a Fedora one, and I said, that looks like a cool logo. And I looked at Fedora, and, you know, the same guy who told me to use Linux Mint, he said, either that or buy a Red Hat license, because Red Hat just works. So I just installed Fedora, because, you know, it's a Red Hat derivative, or I guess... That's the wrong term, because Fedora's a further up the pipe than Red Hat, but it's a derivative of Red Hat in a sense. That's what I'm recording this on now, is Fedora inside of Audacity, because my cell phone recorder failed. It crashed after about 40 minutes, and I didn't realize it until I had finished, but it's probably for the better, because hopefully this audio quality will be better after I remove the CPU fan in my desktop that's running. It's currently running. It's been booted for a long time, or not booted. It's been powered on for a long time, but I haven't entered the disk key, so it's just been idling. You know, that passphrase colon space blinky underscore to get the thing to boot. I should probably unplug it, because it's not being used right now, but, you know, tangents. But after Fedora, after I installed Fedora, I still use it. I like it. Fedora is the just works, right? Just works, Unicode trademark symbol. Just works trademark distribution. You know, zero headache. It only breaks if you break it. It's very reliable. I only wish the update cadence was slightly slower. but sort of after Fedora, I became curious about other distributions. You know, I thought, well, maybe Linux Mint was unreliable and unstable, and apt broke because you know, Mint is a distribution based on a distribution based on a distribution, right? Mint is based on Ubuntu, which is based on Debian, and that's a lot of that's a large chain of failure, if you will. So I tried Debian, and you know, just to find out that no, apt is actually very unreliable. And now my opinion is, when someone tells me they run a Debian OS, I say, I'm sorry for your suffering, because apt is such a pain to use sometimes. You know, it's not very reliable compared to other package management systems. Because it just seems to break randomly, even though you don't do anything to it. But you know, that's all in good fun. I don't actually hate apt. It's mostly just a jab, you know, like RPM versus deb packaging. You know, it's just, they're both tarballs. The metadata is slightly different. The way they get installed is slightly different. But fundamentally, I'm not super concerned about what you use. As long as you use something that works and you're okay with its drawbacks. Let's see, all of the distributions I've tried, Arch Linux, I don't like it. OpenSUSE, it's okay. I don't like Yast though. I much prefer a Red Hat way of managing things, which is by the command line almost strictly, and not trying to use this sort of graphical utility that doesn't really work all that well. Let's see, other distributions. I've tried Ubuntu. I don't really like Ubuntu. The fact that apt pulls in snap packages is enough to make me write it off entirely as a distribution not worth using. Because sort of the idea of I know what I'm doing. I am the systems administrator. But I own this computer. I choose what is installed on it and how it is installed. And if I wanted a program installed inside of a container, I would have used that command, not the one that says install this program outside of a container on my operating system directly. That's kind of my grievance with Ubuntu. Let's see what other distributions I've tried. CentOS, or CentOS. I call it CentOS because it's funny. And I also say MacOS instead of macOS, because people don't like when you say macOS. They don't understand what you're saying, and it's kind of funny to say things sort of phonetically. Although I've never used macOS, and I don't ever intend to, because it's really just... sort of a botched BSD, if you will. At least in theory, that's what it is. You know, with various GNU component, ancient GNU components that cause people headache when trying to do anything on the system. Other distributions, other Linuxes, let's see. Gentoo. I don't know how I miss Gentoo. I really, really enjoyed running Gentoo. I ran Gentoo for about 2.5 years, and I stopped running Gentoo. My desktop computer was in storage for a very long time, and when I brought it back out, I hadn't, you know, ran a portage upgrade or you know, build job or a sync or anything for a very long time. And anyone who knows about Gentoo, who's ever used it, if you don't update at least once a month, you know, if you go for about 9 months to 10 months without updating, it becomes a very, very large headache in order to solve. And what that means is resolving portage conflicts by hand and modifying use files by hand and unmerging things just to remerge them, sort of a multi-step dependency resolution. And I think I had a breaking change with, or some sort of unresolvable conflict with, I genuinely tried, but some sort of unresolvable conflict with, it was either GNOME or systemd. It might have been something with systemd, because if it was GNOME, I would have just removed that ebuild, I think is what it's called. I can't remember. I would remove that atom and chose something else, but it must have been lower in the stack, something I didn't want to bother with. And now I don't have a whole lot of time to run Gen 2, but I really do enjoy Gen 2. It's one of my favorite Linux distributions because you learn so much, and it really, really shows the modularity aspect and the configurability aspect when you can, you know, build a system entirely without GTK components or entirely without Qt components or without, you know, any sort of Pulse Audio whatsoever. You can just black out that line and it just builds just fine, right? It just kind of shows the modularity of it. At some point, I discovered what BSD was. I think now I would probably consider myself more of a BSD guy than a Linux guy. And that's almost purely for POSIX reasons and portability reasons. And also because BSD lets me sleep at night, and Linux is kind of a pain sometimes. But I tried FreeBSD. I installed it on my laptop. I brought that laptop to class with FreeBSD on it. And it works just fine. Occasionally there are, or at least I've noticed, sometimes the graphics kernel module will be a little buggy. That's not a thing anymore, really. I haven't noticed those graphics bugs in a long time. Sometimes audio is buggy, but I haven't noticed that in a long time, right? This was kind of this is years ago, probably about 5 years ago. So there's a lot of improvements in the operating system since then. I also played with OpenBSD quite a bit, and that's currently what I run on my web servers. All of my servers run BSD. I haven't touched NetBSD all that much. I mean, I've done an installation. I think I set up an IRC bouncer, and then I never used it. I'm not on IRC much. I generally like to be... I generally like to be left alone, and I don't generally like to argue about things with people in an environment where your distribution is so tied to your identity that when someone points out a demerit of your distribution, you feel as if it's a personal attack, because you're sort of, you know, you're sort of constructed your world around this identitarian paradigm. I generally don't like those types of environments. Identitarianism, you know, you are not what you think you are. You know, a man is the sum of his actions, not a sum of his imaginary attributes, right? So sort of the intangible things. There's my gripe with the internet anyway. Lots of gripes. Let's see, what else have I used? I mean, I think we've all played with Illumos once or twice. I ran Plan 9 on a laptop that I didn't take anywhere for just long enough to write a couple of Plan 9C programs, and now that laptop runs FreeBSD because I needed to test some shell scripts and C programs against FreeBSD. And also because when writing C, debuggability is important, right? So OpenBSD is kind of somewhat difficult to debug userland programs, and that's because they do ASLR, and it's in a way that the GNU debugger doesn't really like. And FreeBSD is slightly more debuggable than OpenBSD. And then Linux, GDB works quite well on Linux. The debugger hooks into more parts of the system to tell you, you know, what line of your source code things are on. And also, what's the program called? Valgrind, V-A-L-G-R-I-N-D. That program seems to be a little bit more verbose on Linux, although this could be purely anecdotal and pure superstition on my part, but that's why that laptop no longer runs Plan 9. It now runs FreeBSD. I think that's pretty much my software stack. I currently run Linux on my laptop, right? Fedora, OpenBSD on all of my web servers, OpenBSD on one of the desktops in my house. I think technically I run Debian, and I have a Raspberry Pi plugged into the network that does DNS for me, some like DNS blocking stuff. Although it's kind of interesting because sometimes the router won't give, the cable provided router won't give the correct DNS server address. Instead, it gives the second one, right? So instead of sending the local DNS server as the primary, it will send, I think, is it Quad9 or Cloud9? I think that's my upstream DNS. I can't remember which one I set it to. But yeah, let's see. Programming, oh, I guess devices. Let's finish devices before programming languages. I have a Google Pixel phone. The reason I bought a Google Pixel is for the sole purpose of running Lineage OS. What happened was I wanted to de-Google an Android phone. For my job, I need a cell phone. It's a necessary evil. And at least for me, something that helps me sleep at night with a little less paranoia is knowing that most of the operating system and the components required to make the device function and not just be a hunk of glass and plastic and rocks, right? That's what silicon is. You rock we tricked into thinking, rock we tricked into doing math. I didn't want like a flip phone because a lot of those are. Some people might think simpler, but not as free. So on my Google Pixel phone, I run Graphene OS. Graphene OS is a hardened anti-Google ROM. No Google services at all. I get apps from F-Droid. Pretty much, it functions as a cell phone, and an MP3 player and a podcatcher. But MP3 player is the incorrect word because I encode all my music into open formats like OGG. That's the container, right? Because LibVorbis is everywhere. But MP3 codecs, the royalties and whatnot, it doesn't sit right with me. So everything's in Opus. Well, not Opus, whatever. It's in one of the free formats. Not FLAC, because that's too large to put on the phone, but this is something with variable bit rate, right? It doesn't really matter because you're not going to get high fidelity audio out of a cell phone, no matter how hard you try, especially if it's going over Bluetooth or over your oxidized 3.5 millimeter audio jack. And that's been oxidized and filled with dirt, right? The port's full of dirt. And it's oxidized, you're not going to get good audio out of it. That's pretty much my tech stack. Okay, now programming languages. My web language wise, HTML is not a real programming language. CSS isn't a real programming language. PHP, I like PHP. I think it's the only good server-side programming language. Specifically because when you write PHP and you include libraries, you're only including things that have been audited by your distribution maintainer. Where when you run something like Rails or Django or what are the other ones, right? The one, I think there's another Python one. But how the infrastructure for those sort of I guess server side programs is download a bunch of random stuff from GitHub. And you know what makes me not sleep well at night? Knowing that my web server is entirely dependent, right? The security of my web server is entirely dependent on a bunch of people on GitHub, trusting people on GitHub without sort of a third party auditor that is the package maintainer. And those people on GitHub trusting other people on GitHub to sort of do their due diligence and audit their code, right? I don't sleep very well at night. Or I guess I don't know how other people sleep very well at night when their website runs on random things they downloaded from GitHub without even reading the source code. You know, sort of the include someone else's program and then execute the someone else's program function, right? That's also not a very satisfying way to build something. But PHP, that's my web language of choice. Everything else is kind of not, I mean, PHP is incorrect, right? It's not a very, I don't like it, but it's the least bad web language we have. Especially if you're not running WordPress, right? If you write your own, it's actually pretty secure. Systems programming, I like the C programming language, strictly POSIX compliant C. I don't like GNU C because it's too big and convoluted and it doesn't make a lot of sense. And I really, really do not like reading GNU info pages. Whatever pager old Stallman chose, he probably could have just chose the existing pager, but you know, nope, GNU has to be different, right? Different for the sake of being different. I don't like reading info pages. They seem less complete than man pages, in my opinion. And a lot of the ways to, you know, the GNU man pages are incomplete because they want you to read the info pages, but the info pages are incomplete because no one wants to write an info page, because everyone knows how to write a man page, right? What was the starting thought? I lost it because I got distracted about info pages. Something about GNU. Oh, POSIX C, right? I like POSIX C because it's portable. And it's portable across architectures and operating systems. Also POSIX shell for a similar idea. If you need to write something quick, write it in shell. If shell becomes too limiting, if you can't accomplish what you want to do in shell, it's probably time to write a small C utility to fill that spot in the pipe. In the pipe of Unix commands. Let's see what else. Sometimes R, I don't write a lot of R anymore. I did an R course in college, and or no, it was a statistics course in college. And I'm very, very thankful that the professor was an R guy, because I'm not going to pay for a SAS license, and God forbid I have to use Excel for anything, you know. That's kind of my opinion on Excel, is that it's, spreadsheets are the worst possible tool for every possible job. Because if you think you need Excel or a spreadsheet, I say Excel specifically because a lot of people, right, circling back to the sort of Microsoft indoctrination classes, right, the giving schools free Microsoft licenses, a lot of people don't know what a spreadsheet is because they didn't learn the higher level concept. They only know what an Excel is. So, you know, oh yeah, I'll email you that Excel sheet. It's like, is this Excel? What? It confuses me. But I always tell people, Excel is the worst possible tool for every job. If you think you need Excel, what you actually need is pen and paper. And if you know you need Excel, what you actually need is a database. That's kind of my opinion on things. You know, for statistical analysis, R is the best choice. It's free, it's open source, it's a Unix tool. You know, it's based on the S language, right? It's an ancient Unix tool that they made open source. And for anyone curious about R, install RStudio. I think RStudio is open source. They don't ship it in Fedora because of whatever weird licensing. But RStudio is an IDE, and that's kind of the one exception I make for IDEs, is when I'm using R, the purpose is to visualize data, and that is the one context where an IDE is useful, because when you plot your distribution and you compare it to a normal distribution, it's easier to visually see that and visually identify what your distribution looks like. than reading, you know, various values spit out by a function that you don't quite understand, because really at the end of the day, you're just a monkey punching numbers into a computer to tell management that their process is broken, right? Thankfully, I don't have that job anymore. I've recently got a new job, and it's entirely different, but I'm enjoying it. Not having to touch Windows, not having to, you know, that's the only time I'll touch Windows if someone's paying me to do it. You know, not having to fight spreadsheets all day, that type of thing. I already said editor's Vim. I think that's about it for programming languages. So I think that's my intro to computer show with some opinions. Sprinkled throughout. I think future episode ideas I have, I want to do one on why Unix is sublime. I think that would be an interesting episode. Second idea, why POSIX is sublime. That might actually be part of the Unix episode. I still have to think about that more. Another idea I had, why C is sublime, sort of a subliminality, not subliminality. It's kind of a hard word to say, subliminality, right? Words are strange sometimes. Something about C, specifically POSIX C, and the reasons, I guess, discussing the merits and demerits of purely POSIX C, and sort of why I like that programming language and sort of paradigm. Another idea I had was discussing the security mitigations in OpenBSD. That's an episode I'll have to do a little bit more research on. You know, those things leave my head. The things that are sort of permanently in my brain are not necessarily, you know, the specifics on OpenBSD security mitigation. Security mitigations, but sort of the idea that it is secure for various reasons, right? It's not necessarily a security theater, although critics will call it a security theater. But sort of, right? The fact that their web server runs in a cheroot, right? That's enough to make me trust these guys know what they're doing, and so on and so forth. You know, the fact that you don't need a root access to start an X session, right? That type of stuff makes me trust them, even without memorizing the specifics. Another idea, I think I mentioned Plan 9 in the show, and I'm about to mention it again at the very close of the show. An episode about Plan 9. Plan 9 from Bell Labs was a research operating system. It's like Unix, but way more Unix-y. It's pretty much vaporware, right? And there's not a whole lot that ever came of it except for the 9P file system. 9P file system is everywhere. All the Microsoft virtualization stuff uses 9P. Sort of the Microsoft, you know, don't install Linux, guys. Stay on Windows. Please stay on Windows. We have Linux on Windows too, right? Right there. Their Linux virtual machine stack thing that all runs on 9P, all the file transfer stuff. So some parts of Plan 9, right, like private namespaces, that made it to Linux. I can talk about Plan 9 more, but that's going to require, you know, same thing with OpenBSD, research and a list. I think I also want to do an episode on sort of the virtues of the BSDs and when you want. When you're BSD curious, almost. I think a lot of Linux guys are, especially people who have been burned by systemd one or two times. They're curious about what a more peer, or I guess pedigree, Unix system could look like and how you could use it. So that's something I might make an episode on, is sort of which BSD is right for you, and sort of, you know, why BSD is not Linux. Even though the more historically correct approach is why Linux is not Unix, and why BSD is Unix. There are a couple other ideas somewhere strewn throughout there. But if any of these ideas sound appealing, reach out and say something and sort of instruct me on which one to do next. As with all things, feedback is encouragement. So if this hits any eardrums out there, you know, which one of these ideas that I've presented, or I guess potential shows I've presented, is most interesting to you? And which one should I do an episode on? Because I'm really impartial, right? I'm going to talk about this stuff regardless. But if there is an order of preference, or maybe sort of advice on like, hey, maybe we should do the Unix episode before the Plan 9 episode, that way there's sort of a through line, so people understand. Or I don't know. I can't assume that the audience is, you know, expert level on Unix philosophy, Unix ideas. I don't even think I'm an expert at sort of these Unix-y ideas, but that might be something to cover before other things. I'm not sure. So any advice there? It's been almost an hour. I think I'm going to end the show here. Comment or whatever it is, however you want to reach out and say, hey, do this next. I want to hear about this more than that. Or even present me some ideas based on what I've said. And I don't know, I feel like I might have been a little bit negative in this episode, a little bit of an emotional response. But don't take that to heart. I think a little bit of banter is okay. And you have to remember, you know, I am not my tools. You know, say all you want, you know, BSD is bad or whatever. You're a BSD zealot. Okay, whatever you say. But you know, you are more than the tools that you use, right? Tools get the job done, not necessarily, you know, they don't define who you are. Right, just because you don't like, right, I guess just because I don't like a specific way of programming doesn't mean I'm not, you know, a computer user. Right, a man is his actions, not his tools. I don't like this programming language, but in the end, we're both programmers, right? That's the common thing. We're programmers, but with different approaches. Similarly, Linux users, or I guess Unix users, but with different approaches to how to use a Unix system. Maybe I'll try it. That's something I have to think about, right? Maybe less emotional response to these types of things that I dislike. But maybe sometimes the sort of over-exaggerated emotional response can be humorous. Let me know either way. I'm sort of just feeling the waters, what types of things are enjoyed. And I do appreciate humorous content a little bit more than, you know, maybe humorous content that sort of edges close to a line that you don't necessarily want to cross. I almost appreciate that more than sort of like dry, cut and paste content. That's why I've sort of used these exaggerative words like, you know, penance and, you know, context, seven circles of context menu hell, and sort of exercise in futility, right? Because it's exaggerating quite a bit, but the exaggerations is kind of how you feel in that moment of frustration. So I think I'll end it here. Ways to contact me, my website, that's really the only internet presence I have. Is ox19.org. That's 0x19.org. I was kind of surprised the domain name wasn't taken, so I got the domain name, and then when I went to make an account on gitlab.com, I said, hey, I'll just use my domain name. Guess what? It didn't work out. So because someone else, everyone wants to be an opcode. Everyone wants to be, you know, 0x19 or 0x19. Or into 19H or 19H, right? Everyone wants to be a cool opcode. That's what they want their handle to be. So I chose a Plan 9 reference instead because nobody knows what Plan 9 is. So my GitLab account, there's some projects there, some source code. I don't know if any of it will be useful, but there's some trinkets in there. You know, just basically toy programs. I'm not a programmer by trade. I just think it's fun. My job doesn't have hardly any computers involved. My new job, which is, you know, almost makes computing at home more enjoyable. But my GitLab account, you can find that. It's gitlab.com/binrc. That's BINRC. That's a Plan 9 reference. On my website, I think there's a contact page. I have PGP keys there. I haven't tested them at all. So if you have the ability or if you know what PGP is, send me a PGP message. I'm curious to see if I set it up right. I used to run a mail server, but now I'm going through. I just pay Proton Mail for me, because I got sick of all of my mail to Google servers being bounced, and you know it's really hard to run a mail server. Really, really hard to run a mail server when all of the other big mailing companies don't like you. Don't like that you're trying to run your own mail server because they want to make sure they can read your messages, right? Sort of that privacy thing. I guess one last idea before I end the show is a GrapheneOS episode, right? A GrapheneOS mitigation, maybe something on Android. But anyway, thank you for listening. I'm going to try to edit this audio a little bit, see how it turned out. Visit my website, let me know how I did, provide criticisms. I don't know if I really gave any hard opinions, mostly just like almost exaggerative hyperbole, in sort of a sense of sarcasm and maybe even satirical irony at points. Give me feedback. Anyway, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. If not, tell me and I'll stop recording shows. If it was that bad, right?
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.